Good evening and thanks for coming. I'm delighted to introduce tonight's writers at Warwick, Maureen Freely and Jane Stevenson. They are, as most of you know, on home turf. Both teach here, Jane Stevenson in the Center for British and Comparative Cultural Studies, and Maureen Freely in the Creative Writing Program. Jane's first book, Several Deceptions, published last year, was honed in Warwick workshops and is dedicated to Maureen and to David Morley. So it's a cozy and celebratory occasion in that regard. But don't be misled. These are not writers of merely local significance or reputation. The note of internationalism is marked in the lives and work of both women. Maureen Freely is an American who has lived in Europe and on the threshold of Asia in Istanbul. Her work ranges as widely, from novels, four and counting, and short stories to social criticism to journalism. Like her colleague, Jane Stevenson offers us first-class armchair travel in time and space and has traveled widely herself, at least in the latter realm. She was brought up in London, Beijing, and Bonn, and her erudition is vast. It's no surprise that the characters in Several Deceptions should be similarly unconfined. The spell of fiction is itself a several deception. As readers, we only ask to be thoroughly taken in, and as writers, Maureen Freely and Jane Stevenson are good enough to oblige.
Thank you.
Thank you. Maureen's going to start there.
Thanks, Will. Thanks for coming tonight. I'm going to read a story that I wrote just this time last year. I was having quite a bit of trouble with while giving lots of instructions to my students about what they were supposed to do. And I found out after I finished the story that I'd actually followed all my own assignments. I didn't realize it at the time. The story is called Rosebud. And nothing in the story happened, I assure you. My first night at the Rosebud, there's this girl in the corner. She has her back to me, but I can see her face in the mirror that runs along the walls. She has alabaster skin and short, shiny, honey-colored hair, and the hard, fixed look of a doll. A doll that's just about had it with her glass cabinet. She's wearing a jean suit. Every Parisian under 30 has one this year. But there's something about the way she presses her fingers into her crucifix and something about the way she pulls the chain across her chin that tells you she's not French. Her companion, he's another strange one. Short blonde hair, square build. Skin of a 25-year-old, but he's wearing this middle-aged camel hair coat and he has the posture and manners of a retired general. He does not seem at all perturbed by the lack of conversation. He, too, seems far more interested in what he sees in the mirrors, and from time to time, he sees something that makes him chuckle. He chuckles, and then, without fail, he reaches for his cigarettes. Without fail, he offers one to the girl. It is after they have both inhaled deeply and exhaled neatly over each other's shoulders that the man looks straight into the girl's eyes and says, "Mais écoute, Sissi." All he gets in return is a shrug and a pout. At first, he seems happy to leave it at that, but after a time, he decides to persevere. "Mais écoute, Sissi," he says now, "you are overestimating this man's importance. Give yourself a month, and you will hardly remember his name." Even after the shrug and the pout, he goes on this time. "Mais écoute, Sissi, why not go back to Madrid? You are sure to meet someone new there." And so on, but never getting a word in response, until he sits back and says, "One thing you have failed to take into account, my dear Sissi, is that your friend is not his own man. He's in the grip of a perversity that has nothing to do with you, as it is of a purely psychological nature." And finally, he gets her attention. She sits up, and in a gravelly Spanish accent, she says, "Ah, a perversity, how charming. Sergei, this time you've outdone yourself." And Sergei says, "Perhaps perversity is too strong a word. Perhaps it would be better to think of it as a tragedy." To which Sissi says, "Ah, now you are truly surpassing yourself." Sergei replies, "Mais écoute, Sissi, this is the only way of understanding him. The tragedy of this man, my dear girl, is that he has never known the privilege of having a whorish wife." "Ah," says Sissi once again. "You know I'm right," says Sergei. "Ah," says Sissi, "but this is detection of the highest order." She takes a long drag from her cigarette, looks at him, and then says, "So, I take this to mean that you think I should give him back the egg as if nothing ever happened?" Sergei sits back in his chair. Évidemment, ma petite, at the end of the day, what other path is open to you? I can still hear the pleasure in his voice. I can still see that knowing smile. It comes back to me at the strangest times when I'm sitting in traffic or at the dentist's office. Sometimes it even comes to me in court. The faces melt into the woodwork and turn them into mirrors, and I'm back at that table, one table from the corner at the Rosebud, looking at him, looking at her, looking at him again and asking myself, why is it a tragedy for a man never to know the pleasure of a whorish wife? How would his life have been different if I'd been able to understand what they meant? Why was it important to give eggs to men who devoted their lives to women who were not whorish? Why did Cece have no other choice? Why didn't I? Other people that from that same night who come out of the woodwork at me, always in the same order, this dark, severe woman, could be 30, could be 40, wearing a man's suit, hair pulled back like this, blood-red lipstick, silver earrings, silver bangles, silver rings, chain smoker, who isn't in this place? She's sitting with these two pretty but blank-faced boys, and one of them is totally silent while the other one engages in a passionate conversation about Louis Malle. At one point, the woman says, finally, there's nothing unnatural about a woman making love to her son. What harm can it do if they're both made of the same flesh? The talkative boy gives a reasoned response to this, and the woman says, but of course it happens in Lyon, mais quelle bêtise! What it is that happens in Lyon, I'll never know, as her voice is drowned out by a roar of laughter and then the protest, but it's true, I swear, it's true. The speaker is a portly man with a full head of white curls. His hands are streaked with yellow paint. The story he can't get anyone to believe is from his boyhood in Buenos Aires, when he caused a family crisis by giving his grandmother crabs. His set piece, which he does several times, complete with scratching motions, is the visit he pays with his grandmother to the family doctor. When he sees that people from other tables are beginning to listen, he stands up to make himself better heard. This does not amuse the Lone Rangers at the bar, because now he is blocking their view of the mirror. Finally, a tense, tight-lipped woman in a black turtleneck takes it upon herself to tell him to sit down. Her name is Marie-Rose. At least that is the name Mr. Buenos Aires uses when he tells her not to act like his mother-in-law. She does not grace him with an answer. Instead, she puffs her lips out. The way shop girls do here, if you pick out a dress you ought to know is too small for you. She marches across the hall, the packed room, to join the matron and the two thin boys. The conversation is at first inaudible, but then as she rises abruptly from the table, she raises her voice to say, Jean-Baptiste, I'm warning you, not like a dog. It's understood? She catches my eye in the mirror and stares straight at me as if to say, who do you think you are? When she heads in my direction, I think, oh no, what have I let myself in for? But this is what she says to me, and in English. Perhaps you can help me. I am trying to construct a set for a play, and I need to know what color you might have expected a gin bottle to be in South Dakota in the mid-50s. I'm not sure I can help you, I tell her. I come from Kansas City, and I wasn't drinking gin yet in the mid-50s, and I'm afraid my family were teetotalers. Marie-Rose is not impressed. She says, oh la la, and strides smartly back to the bar, where she seems to get the information she needs from these two long-haired bearded guys I know immediately are American because they're still in the clothes they wore to the March on Washington. They put read much too much into her question, and they put everything they have into their answers. But as soon as she gets what she needs, she turns her back to them, and they are devastated. One of them clenches his fist and says, ooh, man! The other one says, can you believe it? They stand there with drooped heads and stooped shoulders, but before long, a sad, elegant, swan-necked African woman sidles along beside them, and they begin to look hopeful again. But Snowball, hell, they must know what their chances are, because this woman is using the mirrors to go after the same guy that Marie-Rose and just about every other woman in the Rosebud is after. It's this other American who's leaning against the bar right next to the door. I can tell he's American because he's wearing work boots and white chinos and a weather-beaten suede jacket, and he has a ponytail that goes right down to his waist. He's talking to the bartender in halting, twangy, but confident French. I can only catch a phrase here and there. Our framework is too limited. In reality, it is not linear because it bends. If you traveled 3 light years, the bartender keeps shaking his head and saying, but this is the stuff of myth, my friend. At which the American says, then let me try and put it like this. He gets so caught up in his argument that he'll light up a cigarette and then just forget to smoke it. He goes for long stretches, forgetting his drink too. But then when he remembers, he'll just down a whole glass at a time. He uses his forefinger a lot. He does not like to be interrupted. And when Murray Rose taps him patiently on his shoulder, he says the same thing to her that he'll later say to the morose Sisi and the swan-necked African woman and all the others who follow. "Honey," he says, in a voice only a fellow Midwesterner would know was crackling with annoyance. "Honey, I'm sorry, but this is just not a good time. As you can see, I'm talking to my friend Gilles here." And he turns back to the bartender and says, "So, where were we? Oh, yes, I remember. This is the gist of it. When the man returned, he would be 80 years younger than his twin brother. This is Earl. This is Earl, but I don't meet him yet. My first night at the Rosebud, I'm not alone. I'm with this super straight guy from the language school. Can't remember his name now. He's doing his junior year abroad out of Cornell, and he's acquired quite a few Hemingway-esque affectations during his time here. He spends most of his time at the Rosebud jotting thoughts into the notebook he takes everywhere, and from time to time, he reads them out to me. They have headings like, 'What if Jung was right?' and 'Can a feast be movable?' or 'What would Clausewitz have had to say to us about Vietnam?' He notices nothing about this secret society swirling around us, nothing that is except for the smoke, which is his other topic of conversation. Every time he gets hit by a really big cloud of it, he looks over his shoulders to see who did this to him. It's like he can't see it, because it could be anybody. And then he says, 'Hasn't anybody bothered to tell them that they're chopping 2 decades off their lives?' Until finally I tell him, 'We're going to have to leave right now, either that or I'm chopping 5 decades off his.' So we go back to the residence. It's only 10 minutes away up this back street on the other side of Boulevard Montparnasse, but it seems longer because it's late and the streets are dark, and the only people we see are the ones you change direction to avoid. My room is dark too. There's only just enough light coming in from the street lamp outside for me to see that my roommate has her hair in rollers. I take off my clothes as quietly as I can. Then I look at my bed, and this thought comes to me that if I get into it now, I'll have to lie in it forever. Minutes later, I'm back outside again, heading up the Boulevard Montparnasse, and there are these two Arabs trailing me, and it's after 2, and all the cafes are dark, and the cinemas and the pharmacies and the restaurants obscure behind their iron bars. And as I head around the corner into the Rue de Londres, the two Arabs have almost caught up with me, and they're beginning to talk to me, and now there's another group of men walking towards me, and I begin to run, and then both men behind me and the men in front of me begin to run too, and I just manage to get to the Rosebud before them, and I hurl myself in and slam the door shut behind me, and then I make my way through the smoke and the whiskey fumes and the competing reflections and the saxophone swallows swirling out of the seekers and the voices riding over it. I go right up to the bar this time, plant myself right next to Earl. I can see his face now, his profile, that is. And it's not what I expected, because he has these deep-set eyes and high cheekbones that make me think he must have some Indian blood in him. He's still talking to Gilles, the bartender. He acts like I'm not there. He's drawn this graph on a napkin, and he's poking his pen through it, trying to explain why, if you were a being who could only see in 2 dimensions, the pen coming through the napkin would look like a point that widens out to become a blot. Gilles has a very hard time grasping this idea, but Earl has unlimited patience. He goes through it again and again. And it must be going on 3 in the morning when Earl turns to me and says, "So, how are you doing? Time for just one more?" He buys me a cognac and soda, and then he asks me, "Which part of Kansas City are you from?" I tell him, and he nods, and he said, "I thought so." Then he tells me the name of his hometown, which I've never been to, but it must be less than 20 minutes away from mine. I ask what high school he went to. He tells me, I tell him which one I went to, and then he says, "Well, that's enough of that." He looks at his watch and says, "So, what do you think? I say we call it a day." He takes me back to his hotel, which is a few hundred yards down the street. It's one of those boxes for pillows, room with a sink and a bidet, you have to share the bathroom with a cast of thousands kind of place. His room smells like socks. There are clothes all over the floor, paper blacks flung here, there, and everywhere, and on the bedside table, there's a folded Herald Tribune sitting underneath 2 overflowing ashtrays. On the table next to the bed is a manual typewriter. There's a sheet of paper taped to the wall above. On it is 1 column of adjectives: throbbing, pulsating, glistening, heaving, bleeding. And 1 column of verbs: ram, grab, suck, punish, conquer. On the top of the dresser are 2 typescripts, one very thick and 1 very thin. The thick one is his novel, he tells me, and the thin one is his fuck book. As he takes off his clothes, he explains how he works it. He spends a week every month writing porn for this outfit that operates out of Monaco, and that's what buys him the 3 weeks a month to work on the novel. I ask him what the novel is about. He says, "Maybe one day I'll know." I ask him how he manages to write a whole fuckbook in a week, and he says, "It was hard the first few times. That sheet of paper you see on the wall there, those are the words I have to mention once every fuck scene. I don't really like to talk about it. Take off your clothes, why don't you? Get down on that bed. The next day, I wake up to a burning cigarette and rapid typing. The bed next to me is empty. I look across the room to see him at his desk. Which one are you working on today, I ask. The fuck book, he says. What's it about, I ask. And he says, that's for me to know and you to find out. Listen, he says, without taking his eyes off the page. You can stick around for a while. It's fine with me, so long as you keep the noise level down. He goes back to his typing, and I just lie there, watching the clouds pass across that little patch of sky, watching the bursts of sunshine turn him into a shadow, watching his features return with the clouds and the white light. I think of all the times I've walked down the street since I got to Paris, maybe even looking up at this window, maybe even hearing him tapping away at his fuckbook, maybe even passing him in the street and never once suspecting that one day when I was supposed to be sitting in a classroom listening to a lecture on Baudelaire, I would be lying naked in this bed watching the real thing. I think how amazing it is that we come from almost the same place but had to go halfway across the globe to meet. I think how amazing it is that I seem to have known without knowing. Suddenly it's clear to me why I chose French as a major, why I chose Paris for my junior year and not Aix or Montpellier, and why, when I went back to the dormitory last night, I looked at my bed and knew that I couldn't and wouldn't lie in it. I think how close I came to ignoring my intuition, how, if I'd refused to listen to that warning, I would have gone to bed as usual and woken up as usual and never known that I had thrown away my only chance. I think what a close call it was, how easily I could have not met Earl, how I could have gone through life knowing that I had missed meeting my fate, but not even knowing what his name was. I think, how strange. I've always hated the name Earl, but in a strange way it suits him. And in a strange way, I'm glad he's ignoring me. I'm glad because I can just lie there watching him type his fuckbook and that gives me a chance to study his beautiful features without his knowing. But he does know, because at 5 he breaks for coffee, and it's when we're in the cafe that he sets me straight. He tries to make it as easy as possible. He says, listen, Lydia, I'm about to tell you something I hope you don't take personally. You're a nice kid. I like spending time with you. I like fucking you, too. But you have to know now that it's never going to be more than that. I never have and never will let a woman take over my life. Woman, I think. I'm a woman. He carries on grimly, unaware that he has just paid me the ultimate compliment. I know what I want, he says. If I didn't, do you think I'd be here? Companionship is important to me, Lydia, but it's the ship more than the companion. I'm a creature of habit. I don't do mornings, he continues, not for anyone. I have a coffee and a roll between 12 and 1. I break at 5 for another coffee, and then I work till 9. I eat all my meals standing up. I haven't had a single sit-down meal since I walked out on my high school sweetheart. I get to the Select about 10. I'm usually at the Rosebud by 1. And then, if I'm not a fucking a woman by 3 a.m., I go over to the OK bar for a hot dog. Now, I know this must sound pretty strange to you, Lydia, because it's not like back home. That's why I'm taking the trouble to spell it out to you. I fuck lots of women, Lydia, and you'll meet them all if you stick around. So, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. This is my life, and you can take it or you can leave it. But then, because he can tell he's upset me, he takes me out for a crepe. Now, if I hadn't known his rule about sit-down meals, this might have meant nothing to me. But because I know it, all I can think is, this man is bending his rules for me. Over the months that follow, he bends many more. When I turn up at the Rosebud, he always says hello to me. Even if he has other plans, he never tells me to interrupt his conversation with Gilles the way he does with the others. If he does have other plans, he makes sure to tell me himself. Then, if he can see that he's upset me, he buys me a cognac and soda on condition that I go straight home. Once, when Marie Rose throws a drink in my face, he comes to my defense and gets Gilles to 86er. Another time, when he's already told me it's my turn, and Alphonsine, that's the beautiful Senegalese woman, tries to muscle in on me, he gives her what for. And when Cece, the Spanish girl, takes to following me down to the bathrooms and blocking my way when I'm trying to come back up the stairs, he tells her that through her unacceptable behavior, she's gone down to the bottom of the list, and she's going to have to wait another 4 days now until he can give her what she deserves. She says nothing. Like the others, she knows it's only a matter of time. The day before I'm due to go back to the States, they each make a point of coming up to me to say goodbye. But I can see the smirks under their smiles, and that night when Earl is asleep next to me, their smirks come back to me. They come back to me the next morning as I watch the taxi driver pile my suitcases into the trunk. As we wait for the light to change on the Boulevard Montparnasse, I know I can't let them win. As I sit with my suitcases in that cafe on the Rue du Lambre, and the hour hand on the clock moves past one without Earl appearing for his coffee, my nerves do begin to fail me. But the moment I hear his voice behind me saying, "This isn't funny, Lydia. Rules are rules," I know it's just a matter of time before he sees that he has no choice but to let me move in with him. I tell him I'm not going to stop him from seeing his other women, but he shakes his head and says, "Things always tail off in the summer anyway." The happiest part of that summer is the month the Rosebud is closed. By now, we are subletting an apartment just around the corner from my old residence. It has a fully equipped kitchen and cookbooks in English. The happiest, happiest day is the day his crêperie closes, and I make a beef stew, and I get him to sit down for it. But it's not always good to get what you want, because when the crêperie opens up again, we're the first customers through the door. It's the same with the Rosebud. And now that we have our own place, and now that I've gotten him to sit down for a meal or two, it tries my patience to spend hour after hour sitting next to him at that bar while he dazzles Gilles with the amazing facts he has from the world of science. All the things that once beguiled me about this place are the same things that now bore me to tears. These paper dolls with their 5.5 sexual innuendos, these stories we've heard over and over and over, and these women who just won't give up, who keep cruising in and out of this place like barracuda, sending special messages to Earl via the mirrors, waiting for me to let my guard down. Why can't this man guard himself? One day I ask him. I ask him if he's ever thought where this life of his is leading him, what his goals are, if he ever worries that he's going to spend the rest of his life writing fuck books, if he really thinks that anyone who stays out until 3 o'clock every morning drinking beer with cognac mixers is ever going to finish a novel. He tries to reason with me. "Listen," he says, "this was never part of the bargain. Listen," he says, "I'm just not ready for this." But little by little, I make more headway. We start going home before three some nights, and some nights we don't go out at all. And now that I seem to have won one battle, maybe success goes to my head, I begin to play with the idea that maybe Earl and I were brought together for a reason. This is a man who's all over the place. He doesn't know what's good for him. He's not a creature of habit. He's a slave to his habits. And unless I stop him and get him to straighten up, these habits are going to kill him. Then there's this novel as to think about. It's only progressed 11 pages since we met, and I'm beginning to wonder if this fuck work isn't damaging his style. I share these thoughts with him. He listens with stooped shoulders and says, "Maybe you're right." As September turns into October, he becomes increasingly pensive. I tell myself it's only natural. He just needs some time to think things through. Then one night I wake up and he's not in bed next to me, and I try to tell myself he's just gone out for some fresh air to clear his head and to think, but deep down I know where he's gone, and I know what he's up to. I wait for an hour, then I throw on my clothes and go to the Rosebud. He's not there, at least I can't see him. I ask Gilles if he's seen him, and he says, "I think you should go home." But then I see Alphonsine coming up the stairs from the restaurant, and I see Marie-Rose in the corner, and I see the two women exchanging nods, and when Marie-Rose heads down the stairs, I'm right behind her. The sign on the lady says, "Occupied," and inside, there's a woman crying. "Please," she says, "please." And then I hear Earl say, "For fuck's sake, Cece, what is it with you? The answer is no. And if you don't put that fucking thing away right now, and I mean right now, I'm leaving." But it's me who leaves, and I don't hear that voice again for 18 years. By now, I'm a solid citizen, married, and dividing my time between my family, my law practice, my gym. I can go for months without even going near a bar. But one Friday, after winning a long shot, I take the boys in the office to this place around the corner. It's not a business haunt, I should say. It's pretty funky. There's blues in the evenings most nights, and a murder or two a year. And when I'm at the bar getting the drinks, I hear this halting, twanging monologue punctuated with a terrible cough about why, to anyone who saw in only two dimensions, a pencil going through a graph would look like a point widening out into an ink blot. I look over my shoulder, and it's him, it's Earl. He's looking a little shopworn, that's putting it kindly. I'm on the verge of walking off without saying anything, but then I hear, "Lydia, is that really you?" He tells me he's been in Kansas City for almost 3 years now. He came back for his father's funeral, and he's been wrangling with his brother over the will ever since. As soon as he gets it wrapped up, he's heading back to Montparnasse. "He can't understand how I can hack it here," he says. "In his absence, the country has sold its soul." I say, "How's the fuckbook business?" And he looks at me and says, "Do you think I'd even be here if it was good?" It's so strange when you see an old flame who's fallen on hard times and who's become his own caricature, who's lived unwisely and wasted all his talents, who maybe never even had any talents to start with, who maybe lived unwisely to cover that up. You think, "What was I thinking? What did I see in him?" Why did I lose so many years of my life trying to see into his shadows and trying to ask myself why I wasn't enough for him? What a fool I must have been. Did I make it all up? It does me good, it does me good to drop by that bar from time to time and see how little there is left to him. It's always the same conversation. It's like putting on a record, except he doesn't know it's a record. It's clear some of his brain has gone. He's always just one step away from resolving that legal wrangle with his brother that will allow him to go back to Montparnasse, or about to drop the whole thing and damn his brother to hell and help this great new friend of his take a sailboat to the Mediterranean via the Canaries. I don't believe any of it for a minute. But one day I drop by and he's gone. It's almost exactly a year later when I get a call from his brother, who tells me Earl's back in Kansas City and in the hospital and has been asking to see me. The story, as far as his brother has been able to piece it together, was that he was en route to Paris via the Canaries when he got into some sort of trouble in a bar in Barcelona, where he was either drugged or beaten up and abducted. At some point, he lost his memory, the brother tells me, and it hasn't come back. But when I go in to see him, he knows who I am. He stretches out his emaciated arms and makes me sit on the bed with him. I can hardly bring myself to look at him. His skin is so tight and taut, you can almost see his skull. His gums are black, and he smells like sour beer. And he says one thing over and over. The next time you see Gilles, you make sure and tell him that I saw not one, not two, but three bearded ladies in Lisbon. And I promise, even though I don't mean it. I haven't been back to Montparnasse in almost 20 years, and I'm not about to go back now. But it's strange how things happen. A year or so later, the firm has to send someone to Paris to see an important client, and I volunteer. I'm still not sure if I'll have time to visit my old haunts, honoring an ex-boyfriend's insane last wishes. Is still at the bottom of my list. I go straight to work the moment I hit the city, and we're still at it after midnight. When I get to the hotel on the Rue de Rennes, I'm ready to drop. Then, when I've taken off my clothes, there's this moment when I look at the bed, and I tell myself, Earl deserves better than that, even though, to tell you the truth, I don't really believe it. But never mind, 10 minutes later, I'm walking back into the rosebud, and I have to laugh because nothing has changed. It's as packed as I left it, with the same sort of people playing the same games of the mirrors as they chop 2 decades off their lives with as many affectations as they can muster. The same saxophone solo is weaving its way through the same tangle of arguments that suggest so much more than they reveal. Gilles looks right through me when I ask him for a cognac and soda. We have a friend in common, I say as I pay. But I have many friends, he says. The friend is Earl, I say. And Gilles makes a grimace and says, I have many friends, but Earl does something else. Have you heard the news, I say. What a question. Let me tell you what I know, he says. He went away 5 years ago, just for a month, he said, but he never came back. We know nothing of him since then. I am sorry, but in my opinion, this is not the conduct of a friend. A friend would have sent a card at the very least. He sent me instead, I say. And now I shall return the compliment, says Gilles. If he wants to send me a message, he can put it in writing. And so I tell him it's too late. Earl is dead. I have to shout because he's away down the bar by now, and I have to speak over talking heads, but when they hear what I'm saying, they fall silent. A woman next to me puts her hand on my arm. What name did you say? I tell her, and she claps her hand over her mouth. The man who's with her turns around and shouts over to a friend at the table. It's Earl! He's dead! The friend gasps. At the next table, a woman screams. And now in front of me is you. Tell me how it happened. When I explain, not just to him, but to the crowd of anguished faces that now surrounds us, he breathes in deeply and says, I should have known. I should never have doubted him. But why did he never think to call his friends who would have helped him? We don't know why, I say, but by the time he was returned to his family, he'd lost his memory. But they had not lost theirs, and they devote the rest of the night to sharing stories about their lost friend. There are moments when I think there must be two Earls, because I cannot connect the things they say about their Earl with the things I know about mine. One woman talks about how Earl saved her from death by correctly diagnosing a malignant melanoma on her lower spinal cord. Another talks of the way he could take any car of any age and somehow spirit it back to life. He was like a guardian angel, says one man. Another says, if it weren't for him, I would still be a drug addict and a thief. He had a mind like an encyclopedia, says Gilles. There was nothing this man did not know. But he didn't exploit it for personal gain, says another. He employed it for the common good. He gave us his life, says a woman over and over. Every time she says it, she looks me straight in the eye, but not accusingly, as she should do. To my shame, she addresses me as a fellow mourner. If she were less upset herself, she would see that this is the one thing I am not. But it's not clear to me how sane she is. She has pale, watery eyes and this limp, spineless look of a rag doll. Whenever Gilles pours her another cognac, she crosses herself in a way that makes me think I must know her. When dawn comes and we gather up our things, she says, in an accent that's suddenly more foreign, Gilles, will you let me just this once, for old time's sake? And she says, you don't need to give me anything, especially on such a night. But you know how much it means to me, she protests. She thinks about it, and then with some reluctance, he says, all right, just this once. Think of it as an act of atonement, she says, as she reaches into her handbag, and she gives him an egg. Thank you.
We're just going straight on?
I think we should, yeah.
Right, well, thank you all for coming. What I'm doing is, apart from that first trick, I'm proposing to read The Beginning of London Bridges, which is the thing that's coming out in April this year, and in which I have totally lost interest, because that was, it may be coming out in April this year, but that means I finished it something more like April last year because of the nature of the process. And since then, I've written another novel, which I finished about 3 weeks ago, and by which I'm absolutely gripped. And it's the nature of this process that the thing you're working on now seems to you so much more interesting and so much more important than anything you've ever done before. It sort of persuades you to get through to the end of writing 100,000 words you're not sure anybody wants to read. It's a species of mad optimism. So I'll give you a bit of London Bridges, and then I'll give you a bit of the new book, which is called Astraea. Now, London Bridges is a sort of attempt to write a classic golden age of detective fiction thriller in the 1990s. Don't ask me why I thought this was a good idea, because I don't know. But anyway, it's what I did. So bearing in mind it has a sort of relationship with that particular genre, the opening may begin to make more sense to you. London is a town for fog, mist swirling up from the river, the darkness between streetlights. But though it is never summer in the London of the imagination, the streets are as answerable to sunlight and long evenings as any capital in Europe. There are hot, still August nights in Mayfair. And on one such, Janine Malone had just found out about the Greek optative. On such nights, when visitors ebb and flow in vast human tides through London's centres of shopping, culture and entertainment, in Mayfair, though it lies between the sun-baked and yet inviting grass of Hyde Park and the manifold entertainments of the West End, secret flower-adorned mansions of stock brick and stucco maintain a patrician silence. Unguessed, unseen lives move in secret channels beneath the surface, and the streets are as deserted as the mountains of the moon. As the Greek couple turned out of Park Lane and looked down the long and dusty length of Mount Street, they saw nothing moving at all except a feral cat, white paws twinkling jauntily in the grey evening light as it slipped at its leisure from beneath a BMW to a new lookout point behind the front wheel of Jaguar. The woman's sharp heels set up flat clacking echoes in the silent street. About halfway down, the Queen Anne Dutch frontages were briefly punctuated by a squashed-looking parade of shops built into the ground floor of numbers 40 to 48. The third shop remained lit, a little yellow beacon in the blue summer night. There it is, murmured the woman. As they approached, they saw the windows were bright with images of tanned and exquisite women, while the shop sign running the length of the frontage showed a mortar and pestle and the words Mount Street Chemists. They approached the shop, and they found they were able to peer over the top of the window display into the lighted depths. Within, a girl sat alone, resting her elbows on the counter, hands pushed into her dark curly hair, studying an open book with great concentration. Her plain white blouse was obviously inexpensive, and she looked very young and small. The woman smiled to herself without humour. A student, she suspected, studying for exams. Ideal. With her mind full of her own problems, she would hardly notice they had come in. Taking a last look along the deserted street, the man stiffened and touched his companion's hand warningly. Another man had emerged from the side door of the Riad Gallery and was rapidly approaching. The woman slipped her arm through the man's, and they turned away, unhurriedly. Sebastian, as he came level with them, saw nothing more than a pair of elegant shadows, their faces obscure as they stepped away from the brightness of the lit window, and did not give them a second thought. He went up to the pharmacy door and pressed the night bell. Inside the pharmacy, Jeanine Malone heard the buzz, hastily shut her book and pressed a button under the counter to admit the late customer, who turned out to be an expansive and zestful individual not unlike the late Oscar Wilde in appearance. He had longish dark hair, bright blue eyes, and an un-English ability to address a shop assistant as if she were a human being rather than a mechanical answering device. The man bought some Nurofen and then suddenly decided to buy perfume as well, a transaction which took some time and involved frequent changes of mind. He thanked her courteously as he stuffed his purchases into various pockets, and was just about to leave when his glance swept across Jeanine's book. He flicked his heavy fringe out of his eyes with a practiced toss of the head, put three fingers on it, and swiveled it on the counter till he could see the spine. I thought I recognized it. What on earth is an Aussie pharmacist doing with an ancient Greek grammar? I'm just about to start graduate work at the Institute of Classical Studies. Well, good for you, but that's ancient grammar, not just ancient Greek. Why Abbott and Mansfield? Everybody uses reading Greek these days, surely. Do you know the Institute people? Asked Jeanine, her heart lifting. I'm getting a bit of preliminary reading done for the intensive Greek course with Professor Beckinsale. It was what he asked us to get. Sebastian arched his eyebrows sardonically. Oh, her, in her dreams, dear. Actually, it's not even Dr. Beckinsale, Mr. And chippy about it. That explains it. Our George is a bit of a museum piece in himself, as you'll find out in due course. The thing you've got to remember about George is he's rude to everybody. He doesn't mean it personally. Well, not usually. Can't stand me, of course. But then I have to admit I wind the poor old spook up something shocking. Do you teach at the Institute? She said hopefully. I do a bit of Byzantine stuff for them. We'll probably bump into each other sometime. My name's Sebastian. Bye for now. The door whispered shut behind him, leaving her with the warm thought that she had just met someone she might meet again. After only 4 weeks in London, she knew practically nobody except her current employer, a fat and surly individual called Patel. She looked at her watch again. Only 13 minutes to lock up, and was it really worth staying? Just as she was about to get up and go into the back for her bag, the doorbell rang once more. Two modish silhouettes, male and female, were dimly visible through the glass, and she buzzed them in. Good evening. How may I help you? She said in her best professional manner. The man came forward, feeling in his breast pocket. Good evening. Can you fill this prescription, please? Jeanine took the piece of paper and studied it conscientiously, nibbling her thumbnail. I'll have to check on the computer, she said apologetically. This is a high dosage, and I'm not sure we keep it in that strength. It's very important, said the woman, abruptly. Do right, and patient's used to this amount, he's got to keep on with it. She considered the prescription more carefully. There was something else peculiar about it. The prescribing doctor's address was in Fife, and while Jeanine's education had not been big on British geography, Macbeth, she recalled, was the Thane of Fife. So surely, Fife was in Scotland. The man, watching her narrowly, saw her frown in puzzlement. We came down from Scotland on the night train, he explained. Yes, the woman cut in, and most unfortunate, we find our uncle has forgotten his pills. So we rush out and try to fill his new prescription this very night, the man finished smoothly. How did a pair of obvious foreigners end up with an uncle called Campbell? She wondered momentarily, and immediately answered herself. Quite easily, no doubt. One of her own aunts had married a Hungarian, and she had relatives she couldn't even spell. I'll just go and see if we've got some. I'm a temp here, so I don't know the stock that well. Could you substitute another drug if necessary? Asked the woman. Not without ringing up the doctor. I don't want to alarm you, but this stuff's a bit specific, and you can't monkey with it. If I get it wrong, you and the old gentleman could end up having a rough night. Oh, it's too late to bother the doctor, said the man hastily. If you haven't got the right stuff, just leave it. Jeanine excused herself and went through to the back of the shop. The couple puzzled her. Our uncle? They were both handsome, well-dressed and Mediterranean, but they did not look like siblings. And neither of them was wearing a wedding ring. Well, none of her business. Probably some kind of weird extended family. She typed the prescription into Mr. Patel's computer. It's not for me, a pharmacist, to criticise a medico, but she did wonder what this Scotch GP thought he was up to. The prescription before her was for a higher dosage than she felt comfortable with. It was within limits of the prescribable, but it occurred to her strongly that if the poor old bloke forgot and took two, chances were he'd not be troubling his kith and kin much longer. Perhaps he should check. She reached for the phone and rang the number given on the prescription. This, as she had fully expected at that hour of the night, gave her an answer phone with an emergency contact number. She scribbled it down and rang it, but there was no reply. She put the phone down with a sigh, observing the computer was flashing back at her victoriously. They had some in stock. She hesitated, in a quandary. But clearly, the stuff had been prescribed, and if the patient was used to it, he'd be better with it than without. All the same, she wished she'd been able to check. She went and took the bottle from its shelf and returned to the front shop. The door which separated the pharmacy proper from the front of the shop was a heavy fire door with a spring, which opened and closed slowly and silently, then clicked into place. Thus, Janine, who was wearing light, rubber-soled sandals, was able to re-enter the shop without the couple realizing that she had done so. They were looking out down the road with their backs to her and arguing under their breath in their own language, which, as she came gradually to realize, was Greek. She got an impression that the man was worried, and certainly the woman was insistent. Janine, apart from the ancient Greek she was laboriously acquiring, had a smidgen of modern Greek, initially acquired during a backpacking year after school, and kept in use during her undergraduate years because she lived in a cheap bit of Sydney. As she waited politely for a break in the stream of words, she found one or two making sense to her. Deleterio came up several times. Thanatos, poison, death. The whole thing was giving her the habdabs. They could be worrying about the prescription, but something about the way they were hissing at each other said not. "Put yourself together, girl," she said to herself, and then a sentence came over loud and clear in the woman's voice. And what Janine understood her to say, unbelievably, was, "Just shut up. Even if we killed him, it wouldn't matter. Who's ever going to know?" Then, as she stood doubting both the evidence of her senses and her command of Greek, the door finally clunked shut. The couple whirled round, looking daggers, and Janine opened her mouth, but nothing came out. "I got your pills," she squeaked, on the second try. "Excellent," said the man, too heartily. "It is a very great relief to us." "You'll be really careful," she asked earnestly. Give him them one at a time and make sure he takes..." I want to tell you a bit about Astraea, which is the thing I've just finished. It's the first volume of a trilogy, which is going to be called Astraea, the Female Rosicrucian, and the Empress of the Last Days. I don't know quite what it is. You might say it's a historical novel. At any rate, Astraea is a historical novel in that it takes place in the middle of the 17th century and involves a number of real people. But it's not perhaps a historical novel in the usual sense, because a lot of things happen which, as far as we know, never did happen. Although it is just within the bounds of possibility that they could have. When I put the three volumes together, I think it's going to be an extended meditation about things like time and heredity. It sounds frightfully pompous. What it is at the moment is an absolutely mad love story. Anyway, the bit I'm going to read you is the first meeting of two very peculiar people. One of them is well known to history. Her name is Elizabeth of Bohemia. She was the daughter of James I and sister of Charles I. And she's quite an important person in European history, because every single ruling sovereign of Europe, with the exception of the King of Albania, traces their descent directly from her. She married the Elector Palatine, who was a German Protestant prince. After the death of the Holy Roman Emperor, the pair, Elizabeth and her husband Frederick, were invited by the Protestant inhabitants of Bohemia, which is a real place, it's not just a place of the seacoast, to become king and queen. And this happened in 1620. The enterprise lasted all of a winter before they were chased out by the Catholics. And that's why she's known often as the Winter Queen. The Dutch court welcomed them as exiles, and Elizabeth and Frederick went to The Hague, where they spent the rest of their lives. Well, actually, Elizabeth went back to England for the last 6 months of her life, but basically, from 1620 onwards, they were sort of festering in The Hague. The Elector Palatine died in 1632, and my story begins in 1638, when Elizabeth is 42, she's been a widow for 6 years, and has 10 surviving children. The other person I'm going to introduce you to is also a historical character, but in a rather different sense, because the only thing history knows about him is his name, which is Omolodju. There was a kingdom in what is now Nigeria called Oyo. It's part of the Yoruba-speaking group of people in West Africa. And we know a certain amount about what was going on in Oyo in the 16th and 17th centuries, and one of the things that survives is a king list. And the ninth king of Oyo in succession is somebody called Onfinran, and the tenth king of Oyo is somebody called Egonodju, and between these two names comes the name of Omolodju, who's in some versions of the list but not others, and who certainly never got to be buried in the royal graveyard. Only people who ended up buried in the royal graveyard are enumerated in the official lists. So there is a problem with this character. Was he a king or wasn't he? So what I've done is to take this person, this king of Oyo, and suggest that he was actually, he fell a victim to local politics, ended up enslaved, which explains why he has this shadowy, partial existence. And when this story starts, Omolodju, who is now called Pelagius, is about 50. He's spent most of his adult life in what's now Jakarta, the capital of the Dutch East Indies, and he's been in The Hague for 4 years. He's become something of a magician, amongst other things, and he's been summoned by the Queen of Bohemia. Now, this starts on the 10th of February, 1639, in a very cold winter. Pelagius stood looking around him, ignored. The sound of argument drifted up from some lower region of the house. Servants passed through on unknown errands. He stood for some time in hesitation, but when a buxom, well-dressed fair woman entered the hall, looking past him at a pair of well-dressed and quarrelling small boys with lively disapproval, he tentatively approached her, removing his hat. "My lady," he began, bowing respectfully, "the Queen has asked to see me." The lady surveyed him, a little perplexed. "What is your name?"
"Dr. Pelagius, madam."
"I'll tell the Queen you're here. James, Francis, stop it at once, or I'll have you whipped. Why did you not ask the doctor his business?" The woman shook a warning finger at the children, who parted sheepishly, and whisked back up the stair from which she had descended. As she turned her broad back, one of the boys put out his tongue at her. A few moments passed, in which he looked around him before she returned. The little boys, after pausing briefly to stare at him round-eyed, had prudently vanished. "Her Majesty will see you now." He followed her out of the hall, full of curiosity, and walked behind her into a room hung with black. The Queen was sitting at the far end on a throne under a canopy. All he could see of her was her face and neck, palely glimmering, and her hands, clouded with point lace.
"Parlez-vous français, Maître Pelage?" came a clear, pleasant voice out of the gloom.
"No, Your Majesty, only Dutch and Latin," he replied, in Dutch. He understood a little English and wondered whether to say so. Comrade, whose father had fled Scotland for the sake of religion in the days of the Catholic Queen, had used Scots occasionally. But since he was far from certain he could string three words together in that tongue, he decided against volunteering the information. It would only create confusion.
"Dommage. Well, Minerre, French is the language of courts, and you are no courtier. Latin is the language of scholars, and I am no scholar. We must compromise on Dutch, then, which is at least the language of the country. I speak it barbarously."
"Your Majesty, you are perfectly clear." He spoke the truth. Her voice was distinct, and her accent fell pleasantly on his ear, reminding him a little of Comrade.
She mixed High German with Low German forms indifferently, but she was fluent. "Tell me a story," she said, after a pause. "What story do you wish, Your Majesty?" When she spoke, her tone was wistful. "Are there truly men in Africa whose heads do grow beneath their shoulders? I have not seen one. I hoped it might be true. There's a phrase, is there not? Ex Africa, semper aliquid novi. There's always something new out of Africa." "It was Pliny, I believe, who said that. And perhaps it is true. There are many things I saw in Africa which would seem strange here. And doubtless many strange things there which I have not seen at all. I have seen Oyo Ile, where I was born, and Ifa, the city of the oracles, and Elmina, the great fortress of the Portugals. I have seen Bornu and Gao, the Sungai Musulmans, where I went to buy Barbary horses for my father the king. I have seen the jungle and the desert, and the plains and the sea, and animals of many kinds. But all the men I saw in Africa were shaped like men." "What is the strangest thing that you have seen, Dr. Pelagius?" "If anyone had told me, when I was in my father's house, that he had seen water, solid like crystal, burning to the touch, with men walking upon it, I would have called him a liar. That is the strangest thing." Elizabeth surveyed him steadily from her throne, one hand absently caressing the warm head of a dog, almost invisible in the dusk, that leaned immobile against her chair. Though she could not see his face, he was an impressive figure, tall and well-built, plainly not in the slightest degree overawed by her. Prince Frederick Hendrik had told her a little of his history, and he piqued her curiosity. An interesting man. Was it the authority of the preacher, or the seer, which gave him such confidence, she wondered? Or was there something else about him, entirely? "Dr. Pelagius," she said, "they tell me you can see beyond earthly sight. Is this not witchcraft? My father would have said so." His deep, beautiful voice was calm and authoritative. He answered questions soberly and directly, without a note of apology. "I am not a witch, Your Majesty. I do no maleficium. I do not call up spirits or make use of the dead. But I believe that the Lord God has it in his power to send messengers who may not be seen by mortal eyes. Did not Abraham eat with angels and Jacob wrestle one? Was not Joseph, the earthly father of Jesus, warned in dreams and visions? I ask that I may see, Your Majesty, prayerfully and with humility, and sometimes I am vouchsafed a vision. See for me," she challenged him. He raised a hand in demurral, visible only from the movement of its white linen cuff. "Your Majesty, I am no mountebank. I cannot summon the vision. I must go where it leads, and I can see nothing in this room. If you come with me, I will go where the sending takes me, and perhaps see for you what you wish to have seen." Her chin rose, and she sat still straighter in her chair, glaring at him. He was not even looking at her. With downcast eyes, he was looking at his own hands as they held his beaver hat by its rim, submissive, poised, perfectly respectful, but obdurate. And she was forced to concede. She looked away from him to the Countess of Loevenstein, one of her four maids of honour, who was standing by very correctly, her large fair face unreadable in the dusk. "Very well, Bess, my furs, wrap up well and fetch Katharina. I want you both to come with me." The woman, almost invisible in the failing light, curtsied and went to obey the Queen's orders. Pelagius bowed and retreated. As she left by the side door at the top of the presence chamber, he walked back down the length of the room and out into the hall, where he stood and waited. Some minutes later, the Queen of Bohemia, cloaked in sable and flanked by two carefully blank-faced gentlewomen, joined him as he patiently stood in the oak-panelled front hall looking at the tapestries. He bowed as she approached, and when her serving man threw open the great door, he offered her his arm. It was neither dark nor light, a winter evening, as they emerged onto the Natterdyke. The sun, well down the sky, was behind the tall buildings, but the sky was leaden grey with black rags of cloud. It was terribly cold, and the cobbles were mailed with tiny pellets of ice,
pale, melted and frozen again, or aggregated pellets of snow. The going was treacherous in the extreme. She took his arm because she was uncertain of her footing. Through his broadcloth, her velvet, the stiffened, padded layers of cloth which protected them both from the savagery of a Dutch winter, she could feel dimly, like a four-month child, the stirring of his breathing. Without hesitation, he piloted her across the Platz and down the Vijverberg, followed by the two women, also now arm in arm with each other, whose presence he never acknowledged. They crossed the open space, walking as rapidly as the circumstances would permit, down the narrow double allée of trees towards the corner of the embankment opposite the new Maritz house, where there was a ramp down to the water for the convenience of cargo. The water was a solid sheet of ice, overlaid with a dusting of snow, and the ramp was as slippery as a child's slide. As he walked towards it without slackening pace, Elizabeth's arm muscles, with no conscious intention of her own, tensed to slow and, if possible, stop him. Looking up at his tall head, so elegantly poised on its long neck, she had consciously to relax her grip. She was used to strong-minded men, and his expression, withdrawn, concentrated, was far from inscrutable. He was a hunter, hunting. What spoor he was seeing, what senses he was using to see it with, she could not guess, but she knew the mood and the attitude well. They descended the ramp with caution. Her shoes, narrow-heeled, skidded alarmingly, but her potential slide was arrested by an arm like an iron bar. She clung to it with both hands. She walked on the ice with mincing steps like a cat, conscious of the freezing air striking up under her petticoats, afraid to slip and lose her dignity, and afraid, on a deeper level, that the ice would crack and swallow them. It was very cold, and the state of the snow overlying the ice, sullied, marred with footprints, scored with curving lines left by skates, showed clearly that many had walked on it. But she found it impossible to rid herself of a conviction of its treachery. The ice was darkest blue, with glass-green highlights, wherever the scuff of dirty brown snow was disturbed, and she was as frightened as she had ever been in her life, and too proud to show it. Pelagius came to a halt in the middle of the ice. "Your Majesty, here I am. If I can see what you wish to see, it is here that I can do it." Elizabeth took a step back, conscious of the presence of her maids of honour, comforting because they were hers and female, and strengthening because she knew they were as frightened as she was, and so she could not shame herself before them. "Master Pelagius," her voice came out thin, flattened by the ice, but confident, "show me my sons. I am afraid for them." His face, already serious, stiffened with concentration. He brought out a flask, and as he opened it, turned to her, holding it out for her to smell if she wished. "Only good Dutch Genever, Your Majesty. Nothing magical about it. But we need a mirror if we are to see." The reek of honest grain spirit came to her nostrils as he tilted his wrist and spilt the liquor over the ice at their feet. As the alcohol spread out in a pool, it melted the superficial snow, the footprints, and the dirt to show the hard, glassy darkness of the ice with its sinews of currents, the little bubbles, fragments of frozen weed held in it. He reached out. Only his glove touched hers, yet the contact of flesh was implicit. She was very conscious at the same time of the hand which held hers and of the fact that her feet were freezing. "Look." She looked down. She saw the black fall of her dress and the sables in which she was huddled. She felt the hard grip of the ice clutching to the soles of her shoes. Before her stretched an inky pool of clear ice. She was worried about Charles Louis, wherever he might be, struggling to raise support amongst the deadly indifference of Europe's kings, and about her poor Rupert, prisoner in Linz. She tried to concentrate her mind, aware of the light hand engulfing her own. "Charles Louis, Rupert, my darling boys." There was something under the ice. In the complete darkness of the water, a glimmer of light, no, not a glimmer, a something. Pale, oval, heedless of her dress, her stiff knees, Elizabeth slid down as it became clearer and clearer to her. Under the ice, under armoured glassy inches, he came up, Frederick Hendrick, her firstborn, her beloved, his skin leaden and pinched with cold, hair waving like black weed, his lovely grey eyes filled with innocent astonishment. Mother, help me, Mother. Mother, why am I dead? Elizabeth fell forward over the ice, grasping ineffectually for her son. It took all three of them, both ladies and Pelagius, to raise her. She turned snow-caked and drenched all down her front to weep hysterically on the Countess's shoulder. Between them, the two women took her away, tacking and slipping erratically over the ice, while he stood unrewarded and forgotten under the windows of the Maritzhurst, startled out of his wits. Thank you.
I believe the next order before we all run to the bar is to ask if anyone has any questions. Raise your hands and I will recognize you. You're too stunned, aren't you? I had a pretentious question, I usually do, which was formulating itself after I heard Master Pelagius say, I can't summon the vision, I must follow where it leads. And this was to do, I was curious about how you both feel, to what extent you choose your subjects, or to what extent your subject chooses you. I mean, I believe your story, Maureen, was commissioned, in fact, and is that right? Time Out said, write about Paris?
Yeah,
or?
and I started writing a completely different story, very complicated story, and with the only character that the other story had in common was Cici.
Cici.
And I'd been working on it for ages and ages when suddenly this other character said, actually, it's me.
Uh-huh.
So I had to go there. I had to cross the Seine.
Right.
Read Neuilly and go to the Rosebud.
So this wasn't really a conscious choice, but it arose out of the work itself. It's yeah, I sometimes wonder, you know, when students of writing sort of say, oh, well, I couldn't write anything. I'm waiting for inspiration. You know, but it's a pretentious rumor, isn't it? I mean, we are inspired from time to time, but I mean, you have to, it comes out of the work, doesn't it? What about you, Jane? I mean, to what extent did you say, I know, I'll write about, you know, what you're writing about? Or did it arise out of the research? I know you did a lot of research.
Well, I mean, you were sort of in on part of this because I was working on it during the Advanced Creative Writing Workshop, mm-hmm. which Maureen led last year.
Yeah.
And the thing about this story is it started as a joke.
Uh-huh.
Well, not absolutely a joke, but as it were a sort of flip, kind of slightly cheap trick idea.
Uh-huh.
And then it got totally out of control, and there was a sort of despairing moment when I said, sort of, how can I write all this? And Maureen said with great firmness, you seem to be writing a trilogy. And I said, I
what every writer longs to hear.
It was a vision of a manuscript 1,000 pages long sort of rose in front of my eyes. I sort of thought, you know, can I not get rid of this notion in less than 300,000 words? And then I sort of reluctantly admitted that this would seem to be the case and that it had become serious and there was nothing I could do about it.
Uh-huh.
So,
but there was that sense of the story of Estrella being in the straitjacket and you weren't allowing it. You had devised this elaborate plot spanning centuries so that the person wouldn't be, you know, the story wouldn't be allowed to get out. And so all we said was, let it out.
Yeah, and so and that's what happened.
Two weeks later you did.
Yeah, well, it's ever since then it's actually been sort of writing itself. It seems to be one of these stories that wants to be told, but quite why, I don't know.
No, and you probably shouldn't know. I was curious, in several deceptions, is this, I think the second story, Law and Order, where there's a lawyer who, almost as a sort of philosophical exercise, decides, can he commit a completely gratuitous crime? Yes? Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, was that inspired by a particular idea? I mean, was it André Breton behind that,
well,
by any chance?
No, it actually happened at the University of Bologna.
Lord.
I'd bought a Guardian to read on a train, and there was this report essentially about two philosophy students, and the professor who got into a very, very strange relationship with the within the University of Bologna.
Mm-hmm.
And another student was shot dead by a shot emanating from the library, and the supposition is very strongly that it was to do with this group who had been talking, who had been overheard talking about this type of crime. What I was interested by was that the person reporting from The Guardian had no understanding of what the issues were at stake at all, because it was making the reason why they couldn't sort of get to this man were not to do with sort of, you know, the mafia or the sort of things one tends to reach for about the deep corruption of life in Italy. It was actually to do with the nature of law,
uh-huh,
which is very, very different from English common law.
If there's no motive, you can't pin the crime,
yes,
on the perpetrator.
Yes, so I kind of thought, well, that's actually a very interesting idea, and I don't want to write a story about Italian universities, because at the time I didn't feel I knew them terribly well. So I thought, I'll write a story about a Dutch university where the legal code is of the same shape.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing in the Bologna thing seems to have been around issues of either sort of closet homosexuality or very clandestine homosexuality. And I mean, that makes no sense in a Dutch context at all, but something which Dutch people are quite closety and neurotic about is issues of class.
Uh-huh.
Which is one thing which isn't really allowed in a sort of brave, free North Sea democracy. And the other thing that they're very closety and uptight about is questions of collaboration in the last war, whereas the Dutch,
mm-hmm,
suffered cruelly,
mm-hmm,
from their occupation. So, mm-hmm, I just shifted the grounds of it, but actually the outline of the story was given as,
mm-hmm,
something that actually happened.
Right, well, that's fascinating. I think André Breton did make this comment in 1920 or something, that the pure surrealist act would be going down and firing at random into the crowd. So,
oh, I didn't know that.
Yes,
I'd have loved it in if I'd known. You should have.
When they were trying to define the gratuitous act. Anyway, so no question. Yes, I recognize you, sir.
A question for Jason. In writing a book set in the 17th century, how much do you find that the trying to remain accurate in terms of story and language interrupted the quick writing? Or did you sort of write something and then go back and take out accuracy?
A bit of both. What I tried to do is to separate the research and the writing. I did a vast amount of research for this, and but the important thing is really to get these people talking to each other. So what I did really was I read an awful lot about Europe and Africa at this time, and then I started writing conversations. The various people in the novel talking to each other. And once I'd got the relationships clear and what they needed to say, then I could tinker with the words to make them more 17th century on a basis of knowledge. The really important thing is trying to not to do both at once. I came to an absolute halt at one point where I was trying to do a dinner party at the Wassenaarhof, which is where Elizabeth lived, and I had no idea who would be sitting at her table. You know, and so I couldn't proceed. So what I did was to write a conversation between Pelagius and the chaplain, who I, you know, certainly going to be there, and then they were, as it were, just talking in this blank void. It was like in front of a blue screen, you know, in the seminar. And then I sort of fitted everything in around them after I'd done the research. So that's how it works.
Anybody else? Yes?
Question for Maureen. Just to look, you were talking this afternoon in different contexts about how a society with no rules holds itself. When you're commissioned to write a short story, do you ever find that there's having to write about a certain place or on a certain subject or whatever, and then things up your way in other ways?
Yeah. Yeah, but the problem with beginning with a place, and I've done along with Russell something for a book of stories about New York as well, is that you immediately begin thinking about your own experiences there, and that's the sort of the wrong place to start. And I think that's why I've always had to write, you know, several stories in order to find a story within the story. So, sorry to speak at such great length about this.
That's it.
One of my faults.
Somebody else. Oh, right.
Yeah, I guess I would ask you a very similar question. It seems that instead of two American couples in New York, I mean, three in Paris.
Yeah. I think what happened in the end is I did spend time living in Montparnasse, you may be surprised to hear, and I did go to a certain bar there. That whole part of my life came back, and I hadn't thought about it for years and years, and I was very, very puzzled. I had regrets that I hadn't ever felt before, and so it sort of came to me, and I could bring it back to life, and now it won't go away.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to have to do something else with it.
Yeah.
But we're done with Earl.
Poor fellow. Anybody else? Well, okay, then I think it only remains for me to thank our writers, our readers, Maureen Freely and Jane Stevenson, and thank you all for coming.